First off, I would like to just say thank you. One of the things I really wanted to feel was that I was being sent by my church. I believe missions is done through the local church, and even just as short-term things like this, I wanted to feel that I was being sent by my church. And I never really said anything, but, you know, I wanted that prayer circle up here before going. And I, just knowing our church, I figured that it would come, and it did. And so I felt supported and sent by my church. I was told I should introduce my family and friends, and I don't have time, so seriously, if I'm going to get through this, I need to move along. So, but my brother and his family, their daughter is here, and a friend I met in college, played ball with for 1 year, and his family and his parents are all here. He's a pastor in New York, so I'm going to call him later, close in prayer or something. He did it to me once, so. This trip was a lot of firsts for me. First time in Africa or Kenya. First time, I guess, preaching, although I kind of looked at it a little differently, but preaching a Sunday morning sermon, that's, I guess, really what it was. But, you know, the thing about going over there, it's like, okay, you're going to be working with an interpreter. It's like, how does that work? How does that go? But, you know, God even prepared the way in that. I'll try to share this because my mind wants to start getting ahead of me. This is Damon Davenport. He's the part-time missionary, maybe full-time. I don't know what you would call him, but this is his family. I didn't get to meet his family. They were supposed to come on the trip, but then some medical issues and stuff that they had to stay behind. But he's been going over 20, 22 years, somewhere in that time frame, where God has just blessed him with, he's got a landscaping business that's multi-state. So, I mean, he's got the money and time to be able to do this. And he's just used what God has provided to go over to this, specifically this one area in Africa, although they go off into Uganda and different trips as well. And he's been doing this for like 20 years. This is our group, starting over on the left. I think I can remember all but one name. We've got Mary Lou, and then Melissa and her mom, which we just called Ma the whole time. I don't know that I heard any other name. And then my cousin there, kind of right in the middle, Joyce or Karen. Then I cannot remember her name. It's like, I know I probably know it, but I cannot come up with it. And then Retta is on the end there. And that's basically our medical team that was going over, and they kind of ran the clinics. I didn't have a picture. I've got a picture of Frank, who is from Northern Ohio, from my cousin's church. I've got a picture of him. But Art, there's kind of a distant picture that'll come up. But this was the first year that we had a direct flight from New York all the way to Nairobi. Usually they had to jump off into another country and kind of get their way over there. But Kenya Airways had a direct flight. When we got over there and landed, this was Jimmy. He was a driver. The backstory with him is he had been hired to take one of the teams up, and they just got talking to him, and he ended up getting saved as they were driving up to the area where we go. And so now every time they bring a team in, they hire him. I mean, he was the driver, like, for the whole week we were there, he was our driver. And yes, they have Awana. And this was a church in Eldoret, one of the bigger towns near where we were. And just saw that picture, and it's like, well, got to get a picture of that. So for here, it's like, I feel like there's so much I want to share, so I'm going to start kind of just the conditions, basically. I mean, we're driving out of Nairobi, and I mean, just bumper-to-bumper traffic, and there's people standing in the middle of all the lanes, selling stuff. Bottles of water, fruit, vegetables, I mean, whatever they got. I mean, these are people just trying to make a living off whatever they can sell as you're driving by. I wouldn't want to stand in the middle of all that traffic. It was bumper to bumper as we were trying to get out of the capital of Kenya. Just as we got outside, there's basically like a national park almost, I guess, just on the outside edge of Nairobi. And so we did see some zebra. I think I saw something that looked kind of like an impala or something, but it was at such a distance you couldn't even see it on a picture, but just kind of looked that way. So we did see a little bit of wildlife, not as much as you might expect if you went to Africa. You'd kind of expect, oh, you see herds of animals, but the area we were in, spending most of our time, it's like we didn't see it. I mean, birds, that's about mostly what you saw. This was a picture from, again, Eldoret. I mean, the traffic, the lanes don't really mean anything there. They had lanes, and like you're going uphill, and maybe one side was supposed to have three lanes, and the other side had two lanes. Well, that middle lane, it's like anybody wanted to use it, used it. And this was actually in Eldoret later in the week, but this is an intersection right here, and the cars are so jammed in together, just trying to crisscross each other. And, you know, it's the opposite driving. You know, you drive on the opposite side of the road, so the cars on the other side are just trying to get around, but it's just so jammed in that, because nobody's really following any rules of the road. It's just, okay, it's my turn, I'm going to go, so I'm going to get in your way and force my way through. And I mean, we were just jammed in there. We're sitting there, it's like, okay, how are we gonna get moving again? Because it's like everybody was just jammed in, and then the people just started walking between you because they're trying to get where they're going, and we were stuck there for a few minutes. But the rules of the road around here, it's like you might have bumper to bumper traffic, but you're still, you know, taking turns, and one time there's a bus that needed to turn right, which would be like our turning left, across traffic. And I mean, it's just bumper to bumper miles. And it's like, how on earth are they going to get across here? Well, I mean, there was just maybe from me to where the road is out there. We're going 45 miles an hour. There's not room to turn. He flashed his lights and went. And it's like, how else are you going to do it? There's no other time to go. You at least they flash their lights and let you know, hey, I'm going to go now. And it's hard to tell what this picture shows, but those stripes that are there are on like a speed bump. Well, it's not like a little tiny speed bump, you know, we have in a parking lot. I mean, this is on the main roads. Every so often they have these. You know, you could get out in the middle of nowhere and they're further spaced apart, but in town, it's just every quarter mile or less, there's this big speed bump. It's probably as wide as your car, and some of them are a little higher than others, so you gotta kinda know which ones are one you gotta slow down more for. And I don't know whether the speed bumps came first or the people or what, but usually where there's speed bumps, then they're selling you things or trying to sell you things. There are people that in some places, they're standing there right beside the edge of the road with stuff in their hands, and when you slow down to go over, they're practically putting it in your window. But again, they're trying to make a living. You know, it's like you see the houses and stuff, and anywhere along the road where you've got a little yard, you've got something growing, and you're trying to sell it. It's the only way that you're going to make any money. We could if we wanted to. So you just had to be kind of careful, especially with food. You know, like fruit, if they said anything where if you pulled the outside off and ate the inside, that was pretty safe. But if you were eating the outside, it's like you had to be real careful about what you ate. At the compound where we were, I mean, they know how to take care of the stuff for us and stuff, and so everything there was safe. These are the side roads, just dirt, gravel. I mean, the road that we were on going down to Choi Meem, where we stayed, was probably the roughest road that we were on the whole time. Now, I know there's rougher roads than that, depending on where you go, but that was the roughest road I was on. I mean, just bumpy to the degree that we don't have anything like that around here. Even a bumpy driveway was nothing like that. I mean, you're talking pretty big rocks and just potholes, just constant. Because when it rains, it pretty much turns into a river. They slope the roads pretty well off the sides, so it gets over to the side. But the thing is, if you can't ride right down the middle of the road, if another car comes the other way and you got to get over, well, you're just basically sliding right over to the side then and right down in all of it. I was surprised how well we got around. Because this was their rainy season, and we basically had showers every afternoon. The last night, it never really interrupted what we were trying to do, but the last night it like poured, it seemed like, most of the night. And so we never had too much trouble. Every time it rained, we were able to be undercover, and so the rain never interrupted us too much. In the past, I guess that has been an issue. This is just to try to give you an idea of what the countryside looks like. I think this was leaving the Rift Valley as we were kind of heading up to Choi Meem. And down in the valley, it's maybe a little more like what you picture Africa to be like. But I felt like there were places where I could take a picture of it if the houses and stuff were gone. Because the houses and the people kind of gave it away more than the countryside. I think I could have fooled you into thinking, okay, this is southern Ohio. I mean, that's what it looked like. Here you're seeing a little more like the mountains and stuff, but up where we got, it was just we were kind of up in the mountains, and so it would just look like rolling hills and trees and a lot like southern Ohio is. It was even cooler there than it was here at the time. You know, we left here, it had been some of those 95 degree days and stuff. We got over there, it was high of 75. I mean, you get up in the morning, you could see your breath just a little bit. So it's their cool season, even though when we flew over, it was the first time crossing the equator, I guess, too. And then when we came back, we actually crossed back into the northern hemisphere. So I crossed the equator, I guess, four times that trip. I could probably get you to think that this is a soybean field. But this, if you can tell from the packs on the back and stuff, is tea. They're picking tea. There was a lot of tea fields up where we were, and in the back there's some corn. Of course, their corn isn't like what we're used to eating. It's more like your field corn type thing, you know. So we didn't really eat much corn when we were there, but a lot of these tea fields, and you just drive by and people out there picking, and I mean they don't get much for the work that they do. That's the one thing I kind of saw is there's just a lot of hard work goes into the little bit that they get for what they do. And that includes the teams that we were working with when we get to the churches. Not far down the road was the Nike training center for the Olympic runners for Kenya. So it's like every once in a while you go by, you'd see somebody running or a group of people running, and those long, tall, lanky guys and girls that you kind of see in the Olympics, and so they're just running all over the place. This one, I had to throw this in because you can see the vehicle where we park right there, and then the first green door is where we would go in, kind of the kitchen area. But what I want you to see is up on that water stand on the back kind of right corner, you see a little white spot up there. Well, about halfway through the week, they informed us that that's actually a killer African killer bee hive. They wanted to take it down, but school was in session before we got there, and it I think the day we came in, the kids had gone home or something like that. And so they're like, well, the bees won't bother you unless you like do something to really bother them. So it's better just to leave them be. If you go trying to get them removed, then it's just going to cause more trouble. And we didn't. I mean, one morning Frank was even tying his shoes on the bottom of the stand, and I'm like, you really want to be doing that? But so we had killer bees right outside our door the whole week. This is the church at Choi Meem. I was only actually in here one time, even though this is where we were staying. It was just like part of the building we were actually staying in. I was only in here like, I think, twice. It's the church that's the furthest along. I mean, it's just a metal roof, no insulation or anything. They don't really need it with the kind of temperatures that they have. The back wall, just they kind of do like a, I want to call it like a plaster type of a job, or I'm not sure what you would really call it. But, you know, when they start off on these, the floor is just a dirt floor, which you'll kind of see in some of the other pictures, but then they'll concrete it, and then on top of that, they finally put some tile and stuff. So this church is, I guess they would probably say this one's completed, but it's definitely the furthest along, and you'll see a lot of the different churches at different stages in the development, basically. But let's see, no, that's not James there, I thought it was. But finishing off kind of the area, the compound we were in, this is the school that they have there. There's kind of three sides of classrooms. And I mean, other than the concrete on the floor and stuff like that and the wall, it's like, it reminds me of Little House on the Prairie. And it's like, that's what they have. I don't think I put the library in, but they, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 books in the library. And that's, I mean, they have, somebody had come in at one time and built a whole bunch of shelves, but there's only about like 5 books on each shelf right now. And that's about it. So they work with what they have, which is very little to some degree. This is, dare I call it, a house where the head of the school stays when school is in session. I mean, this is the kids come in, and if they're local right there, then they just come for the day. But if they're any distance, they actually come and stay. And so the head of the school is there just when school's in session. But that's not really where he lives, but this is the house he stays in. These are the places where the orphanage is. And so each one kind of houses different ages of kids. They are going to collect every bit of water that they can. Like I said, we were there during the wet season, so there's plenty of water while we were there, raining every day. But in the dry season, ignore that. Oh, you can't see it. That's good. I'm getting messages on my pad. But during the dry season, it's like if you run out of water, you're out of water. You know, there was a mile or so away, there was a little creek kind of running down through, but I'm kind of imagining that dries up almost. So collecting water is an important thing. I know when school's in session, if it starts raining even just a little bit, it's like, kids know they have buckets or whatever, and they run out there, and I mean, just nobody says anything. I didn't get to see this, but this is my cousin has told me about it. She's like, all of a sudden you'll just see all these kids running outside and just to collect as much water as they possibly can. This is where they were doing some cooking for the orphanage. They do have some more modern conveniences. I know there's an oven that they can use, but what I found is a lot of times this is what they're used to. And so this is This is how they grew up doing things, and they just continue doing it that way. Here we're just handing out some of the supplies that were bought and sent over for the orphanage, the playground. And these, I believe, were, from where they came from, I believe that these are just like kids from the community. They just, you know, at first they kind of hold back and they're almost like they're scared of you, but then once they get comfortable with you, I mean, I can't tell you how many kids just come up and they're rubbing your arms and just, I don't know what they were like feeling for or whatever, but they just, I don't know. Being right there, I would imagine that every so often a group comes in that it's not like they've never seen Mzungu, white people, but probably very rare. So this now we'll kind of start turning our attention a little bit more towards the actual ministry of what we were doing while we were there. This is the church at Himaki. You got to be careful how you say that, because Himaki is anger. So Himaki. So this is the clinic. We showed up on Saturday, a little bit late, and so the guys, we were going to go help them get things set up, and then we were going to go over to the construction site on Saturday. We got there, and this whole church is packed with people. And so it's like, you know, this is what you do. It's like switching gears. It's like, okay, we need help getting kind of through these people, kind of getting caught up with just sharing the gospel. I mean, the whole point of putting these on is to share the gospel with every one of these people. So this was where I think God's hand was already starting to prepare the way. Frank and I just got paired off with one of the pastors. And just, okay, each kind of take a side and start working your way, just get small groups together and share the gospel with them. And me being me, first time doing anything, I'm always just kind of like, okay, how does this go? You know, and I think the pastor just sensed my hesitation and he just kind of took off. And after about like the first one went, then he just jumped in the second one. I'm like, okay, now I'm supposed to be talking here. So I finally, after he got, I turned around, I talked, and just, now you want me to talk, right? And he's like, yes. It's like, but he's kind of a go-getter kind of a person. I'm just, you know, kind of ease into something, you know, a little more backward about things. And so we got going, and it's like, okay, you know, how much do you say? And then he's got to interpret and kind of go back and forth. And, but it got going, and we just, from one group to another, worked our way back through. I know I heard a number at one point of like how many had accepted Christ. You know, it's like what I liked was not really worried about the number, but everyone who prayed after we shared with them, there was a person that kind of came in behind you and talked to them and got their contact information. And so it wasn't just kind of a one and done and boom, you're gone. And so there were quite a few that prayed after we shared the gospel with them. We just kind of kept moving on. So, you know, it was not that I'm really worried about counting numbers or what, but, you know, I'm also kind of leery a little bit of, you know, Joyce has told me in the past that if they think they won't get what you're giving, if they don't accept, then, you know, sometimes they'll just do it. But what I like is that they get the contact information. And so then they're able to go back in. And it seems, from the way they talk, it sounds like every time that a group comes through and stuff, there's always some new people that start coming to church. And so I know there was just down the road, we couldn't really see it. There was a Catholic church. And like we this was on Saturday, but then on Sunday, a lot of our team came to this church. I was at another place. And so there was, I think, a lot of people coming by our church. because when we finally got over there, and we were out there handing out gospel tracts to probably a lot of people that were at the Catholic Church that morning. And I know at one point they had even talked about walking down the road and going to witness to the Catholic priest. But as we were so busy doing stuff, it's like, I don't know that anybody actually did that or was able to get down there. I know there was a school down the way because we had a lot of like teenage kind of kids coming by at different times. And this was Stephen. He's the one that I got teamed up with. And then later found out that this was the pastor of the church where I would be speaking. So it's like, later on, I got to talk to him, and I'm like, yep. I first get there, and I'm so quiet and not just getting out there. And he's probably sitting there thinking, and this guy's supposed to preach at my church on Sunday? But it was good because it got us working together and stuff. And so then it was like, oh, he's the pastor of where I'm going to be. Now, I still didn't know for sure whether he would interpret when I was speaking. I kind of figured he would, and he did. And so it just made it so comfortable when I got up there. I was like, yeah, there was still nerves and stuff, but just having him there, it was kind of fun. I tried to get Brett to come up here and, like, be my interpreter while I was up here, because every once in a while, it's like you kind of like there's some interaction between you and the person interpreting for you, and it got kind of fun by the end of it, just having that, just kind of sharing it, and it was also comfortable because you knew that if I said something that they wouldn't understand or said it in a way that, okay, yeah, that's how Americans would think about it, but you knew that, okay, he'd take it and tweak it or adjust it, and the point would get across to what you were trying to say. So this is just one of the pictures where we got a group just sharing the gospel. We also gave out a track to each one. You know, I can't guarantee that every single person that came through got the gospel shared to them, because I think there were some that kind of would sneak around a little bit and try to dodge you a little bit. But I mean, most of them, at least the times I was there, we were getting to touch base with pretty much most of them. And a lot of them would come up. If you hadn't given them a gospel tract, they would come. They wanted one. And it's like, you know, that's the part where it's just so different. Seemed like there was something else I wanted to say there, but this was, again, the road out in front of the church. Once we got through all the church, we just went out there and started handing out tracts. And again, this is where it's like if you handed out some and other people saw, hey, they got one of those, hey, I want one, you know. I'm not sure if they knew what it was at first, but everybody that you talked to there said that if they take one from you, it's like they will take it home and read it. It is very important to them to know. And so, you know, it's like there was a few that didn't seem interested, but a lot of them, it's like they'd come by and just slip it in their pocket. And you know, here it's like you just kind of wonder if they would read it, but there they were saying, no, if they take it from you, they will read it. They want to know and understand. And whether they choose to believe is just another story. But this is probably my favorite picture. Didn't even know it was taken, but this was a guy. I don't know that I ever even heard his name. We just got into a conversation before you even think to introduce yourself kind of thing. He claimed to know Christ as his Savior, so it wasn't a salvation sharing moment, but we probably stood there for 10, 15 minutes he had all kinds of questions, and it was probably just my favorite conversation of all of them that I had, and it's just, next thing I know, somebody comes up and shows me they had a picture of it, And then looking back, it's just like, wow, of all the conversations that you had, that's the one that got a picture. And so it was just a really good conversation, a really deep spiritual questions that he was asking that just went beyond, do you believe in Jesus? And you can tell he's one that seems to be growing in his faith and just really interested in what the Bible has to say. And it was, I guess, just the conversation that I really enjoyed the most. These are the Bibles, not all of them. They wanted to get a whole bunch of them out and set them up and make this big display, and I'm just like, oh, we don't need to do that. It's like, let's just get one box over here. We'll set a few out. And the Bibles, these are Swahili printed Bibles that they purchase over there. I think they cost around $8 a piece. So my math is right. We basically bought about 125 Bibles. It was kind of discussed. I was pulled into a conversation just to make sure that they were doing what we wanted them to do. And it was like, well, if we just pull these out and like start giving them out at one of these sessions, at one of the clinics, they wouldn't last long. It's like, as soon as you start giving out anything like that, it's like, whether they really want it or not, they want it, you know. So it was determined that, because there was only so many of them, what we would do is divvy them out amongst the different churches. I was thinking there was five churches, but I can come up with four in my head. So there's like four different churches, and they were going to take boxes of the Bibles around to the pastors, and then the pastors could determine, like, okay, this is someone who really wants to read and study, and they would be able to pick out who really needed one or who really wanted one and would make use of it. And I liked that idea because it would, like some of the other things that we were passing out and stuff, it's just, sometimes you think, oh, they're just taking it because somebody else got it. And, you know, I like the idea that the pastors would be able to get them because there is just so many of them. You know, if you had enough, like the first day at Himaki, I mean, they saw over 200 people in the clinic. So they would have lasted like half of a day. And they would have been gone. So, you know, you couldn't supply everybody with one. So I kind of like the idea of getting them to the pastors and letting them kind of decide where they would go. I'm going to have to speed this up, unless you guys are willing to. This is the church at Himaki. So this is where the first clinic was. That's Pastor James in the black. He actually is kind of covering two churches, the Choi Meem where we stayed, the one with the banners and stuff up that we saw earlier. And this is David. And I think he's the one that's basically has just finished up, like, I guess what we would call it, kind of call seminary. And he's going to be taking over at some point. So Pastor James is kind of covering two churches. These are some of their kids that did a skit. They actually did it at this church, but because, like, I wasn't there, so they did it again later, but somebody else didn't get to see it. So they ended up doing the skit three times, once at the church and then twice down at the compound where we were. This is Frank, and he did the speaking at Himaki. And that's Pastor James did the interpreting for him. He's a lot like me, very low-key and laid-back, and they are a little more expressive, emotional, and you could see that. This is where they called this a hostel. It's not really finished inside, but eventually it'll be like where the teams come and stay. And this is over at Missouriate. And so this is the church that I preached at was held in this building. The church that we were working on is like right next door, right beside this building. And the passage that I spoke on was Philippians 3, 12 through 21. Now this came from those of us, I think it was on a Wednesday night that were here that saw that Francis Chan video about the rope. That stuck with me. It kind of hit home, and you know, it's like I saw some things that I've struggled with, and you know, just verse 19, their mind is set on earthly things. And you know, I guess being a young man, it's like I could see that in myself. I hope I'm starting to see some of that changing. And so, you know, I just kind of worked my way through there and was able to share that. And I even made myself a rope and colored the end red. And, you know, you just wonder how it comes across to other people, especially from another culture. But I don't know what it says, but Pastor Stephen afterward came up and asked if he could have the rope. So I don't know. It seemed to hit home to him anyways. But that was just interesting that we saw that video just a matter of a few weeks before I left. And it was just like God said, hey, I got something for you to share. And that was just a fun one to share. But this is the clinic that's in the other building, that more square-shaped building, right next to where we were working. This is the church that we were working on. And yes, that is me up there on the scaffolding, made out of just tree limbs, hammered and nailed together. And the footing was about as bad as it looks. You had to be very careful. I wasn't up there very long. Like I said, everything they do is labor intensive. They're basically mixing that mortar, I'm not sure what else to call it, down on the floor. And I got some pictures about that here real quick. And then they got to just kind of throw it up there, and then you scoop it up with a little trowel and throw it against the wall, and 90% of it falls on the floor. And then they scoop it up and give it back to you. And I mean, just labor intensive. But in case you think, oh, that's just for a little building, no, they use that kind of scaffolding on very large buildings. I don't know. I'm not sure I want to do it. So here's mixing up the mortar. They just dump a bunch of sand on the floor and pour some concrete bags on top of it, and then you just scoop it from one pile to another, and it kind of mixes it up. So, like I said, labor intensive. But there's the wall that I was working on before and did very little to, but in the end, that's what it ends up looking. They mix up this white kind of stuff, I'm not even sure, and that's what goes on it, and then I guess that can actually be painted on top of that. Yeah, it's some type of a sealer, cure type thing, and they can actually paint on top of that then. So, and there's a couple of Americans sitting down there relaxing while everybody's working. The welder in the back in the yellow shirt kind of, I mean, we couldn't hardly communicate, but we kind of, I don't know, became friends. We had taken just some ball caps in, and it's like for all the workers, and it's like, oh, everybody wanted one. And he wasn't there when they handed them out the first time, but he asked if there was another one, and yeah, we have a few more. We'll bring them in. And the next day, brought in some more, and I mean, everybody knew about them then, and it was just, and they just went, and I saw him run from one building to the other and get up there and just turn and walk away, and there were young kids, which helped out somewhat, but to me, it's like, who they were brought for, it's like, and he wasn't getting one, and I'll give him credit, he didn't make a big deal about it, but he just turned and walked away. So that next day, I'm like, are there any more left? And we had just a few more left. I'm like, do you mind if I take one? I'm going to get one to him because it's like he really wanted one. And so I walked in the next day and I'm like, And you should have seen the look on his face. He just, but somebody, I don't know, I guess somebody would keep him in mind and knew that he wanted one so much. Labor intensive. This is just some angle iron. This is Wycliffe. He's kind of like the head welder and for that part of the crew, and they're making the frames for the windows from scratch. So you got a hacksaw, you're cutting them apart. I mean, there's somebody with a hacksaw cutting that metal almost the whole week we were there. And Wycliffe kept telling me we had to build the sawhorses that we were working on there. And so I was pounding nails and stuff, and he kept telling me to move my fingers. And I didn't listen, so I ended up visiting the clinic at one point in time. Well, there's Frank putting together some of the windows. Like I said, they're making them from scratch, fabricating them right there as we went. He hasn't done a lot of welding, but he has in the past, so he gave it a try. They asked me if I wanted to, and I'm like, not if you wanted to actually stay together. It's like, I've never done it. So those are the windows that they actually can swing out, the top parts, and they'll get the glass and put it in. This was just one of the guys that we were working with and got to talk to. Every so often you just had that opportunity, not as much as when you were at the clinic, but to share your faith and talk to them. And they're just as interested in things about over here as we are about kind of how they do things. This is over at Catali. This is where we kind of split up, and people working stayed at where we were, and the clinic people went off to Catali, is a 2.5 hour drive away, and stayed over there. Again, you can see there's some rain, but this church is not as far as long. The roof is still getting put on, and so each one's kind of in its own state of like how far along it's gotten. This is where they were sharing the gospel with the people that came. The one on the left there is Robert. He's the pastor of the Catali Church, and I believe that's David again sitting there. He kind of tagged along with everybody, you know, wherever we went. This is just like one of the, I think, just outside the Catali, just the kind of that's a town. It's like, you know, very, you know, even their stores and are just, you know, rusty roofs, and a lot of them don't even have doors, and you just open to the air, and that's the way things are there. You know, it just makes you grateful for what you have, because they get along with very little. This gets us into now. I can do this last little part really quick. This is like the last day. At this point, we've flown back to Nairobi. Between flights, I mean, we had most of the day. So it's like, well, there's a couple like animal places we can go to, and this is where they're raising orphaned elephants. And so these elephants have to be bottle-fed, basically, every 3 hours. So it's a lot of work. And they can only basically work with them to a certain age, and then it gets, I guess, just too dangerous. But they raise them so that they, you know, they're basically, they're in a big pen. I mean, it's acres and acres. But they're raising them in a way that when they get old enough, they should be able to go out and back into the wild on their own. They don't have to stay there. I think they've had a couple that they were having issues with, but it was really neat. I mean, they had like two different groups, I think, that came in. I got a little distracted at one point because there was a warthog that I found stalled behind us. This was just another place where this is more like a pen, almost like a zoo type thing, where they have some giraffes and there's some warthogs in here, but the people can feed them. And so I mean, this thing's, I'm like this trying to get the picture. It's like right above you. But big warthog. And what's really interesting, that some of the food that they have that they're trying to feed them falls on the ground, and they actually just get right down on their knees and actually just walk around right on their knees to get their mouth down to the ground. So, and then this was the restaurant called Carnivore. And you see the little flag in the middle of the table there, and as long as that flag's in there, they just keep bringing meat around. And they just have it on these big skewers and different things, and just all kinds of different meats. And alligator tastes pretty good, actually. Oh, no, it was good. But, so, you know, that was that last day there. That was more of our kind of fun day and just getting to experience some different things. But the rest of the week, you know, it was pretty focused on what we were doing. And I know the clinic saw over 1,000 people. I think the number was 1,090 people came through the clinics. There's, I'm sure, more than that that actually came at Hamaki. There were people that actually they had to turn away because we just ran out of time. You could only see so many people, and they just kept coming. And at first I was kind of like, all these motorcycles kept coming up because there's a ton of motorcycles there. Well, they kind of use them like a taxi service. And so once they start learning that, oh, this clinic was going on, I mean, there's people that they just kept back and forth, just taking people up to the clinic, and it's like all day long. Even after, it's like people are starting to get turned away because they either running out of medicine or running out of daylight. But over 1,000 people came through the clinics, and so pretty much about 1,000 people got the gospel shared with them directly, and they all got a gospel tract, and then we handed out, I mean, literally probably 2,500 to 3,000 tracts while we were there. The one day, even when we did get to do a little bit of shopping, the Damon and some of the pastors that were there, they went out in the parking lot, and they said they handed out 200 to 300 tracts just in the parking lot while they were waiting for us to finish up what we were doing. So the gospel went out a lot to a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, it would be, in the bigger cities you would have seen, like, you know, hospitals and stuff, but, you know, like for us, it's every little town has its clinic and stuff, and that's not true there. I mean, they almost have ongoing medical issues. I know, like, one of them, and again, I've already told people I can't remember how to say the name of the disease, but they get it from their cows. And if you work with a cow or drink the milk or eat the meat, then you probably have this disease because they don't have the money to treat their animal or get the medicine for themselves. Or it's like, and so it's just ongoing. And almost everybody that came through the clinic needed that medication. And so that was one that they just kind of kept running out of. They'd go down to the pharmacy in town and buy up everything that they had, and you know, and it was, so it was just ongoing. But they can't afford to go, even just go down and get the medicine themselves. I'm not sure if they are able to do that or whether they have to have a doctor's prescription or.
So is the clinic for like little stuff or like big wounds too?
They take care of some bigger wounds. I know it's like, I don't know, I didn't hear of any this year, but they almost always have somebody like come in with a machete cut on their leg. Because it's like, I've seen them out there driving down the road and how the way that they cut the grass is with a machete. And they're just swiping, cutting it down. And yeah, it's like, every so often they're just going to, oops, cut the wrong thing. But it's like every year it seemed like they had somebody that had a wound like that. But yeah, there is a limit to what they can do. I mean, most of the ladies you saw there, they're nurses or retired nurses. It's like, you know, there's not really any surgeons or anything that we have going with us, at least at this point. So yeah, that, there is a limit to what they can do. I know there was one boy had a, I'm not sure what kind of a tumor or something there was growing on the back of his neck. They actually went with Pastor James, his wife. They took him down to Eldoret, actually, and took him in and saw a real doctor. And actually, before we left, he had had surgery and had it taken off. And it was paid for by basically Damon and the money that he gets. No, we just had nurses. So, but yeah, so there is a limit on what they can do. But all right, it's 12 o'clock already. I was trying to keep it short, but if there are any more questions, I'd like to answer them. But I think I'll close in prayer at this point, and then, you know, you can come up and talk with me. There's more pictures than just that. That's just what I felt like I could get through, and I didn't quite do it as quickly as I was hoping. But let's bow our heads and we'll close in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you just for the opportunity to share what we were able to do. And we know the gospel went out to literally thousands of people, and we know that you promised that your word won't return void, that that's going to impact them one way or another. And we just pray that they'll think about what they've heard, they'll read the tracts, they'll go back to the churches that they came to get treatment and just to seek out the real treatment that we all need, and that's salvation and taking care of our sin issue. And so, Lord, I just lift up to each and every one of them that heard the gospel or got a track and ask you to work in their lives. And there's contact information that's been gotten. And I just pray that the pastors of the churches there that will be able to use that and to reach out and impact these families for eternity. And Lord, I just thank you for the opportunity that I had and for the support that my church family has given me, and my family and friends and everyone who had a part in sending this team over and helping to provide the needed materials and just supporting fellow believers halfway around the world, even in just small ways that we can provide needed supplies or medicines or even just the Bibles that they'll be handing out over the next few weeks or months. Just thank you for the opportunity that you gave me. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.